It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. There are people who are afraid to try new things, right? But then there are people like A.J. Jacobs.
I'm the author of The Year of Living Biblically.
A.J.'s Year of Living Biblically was exactly what it sounds like. And it started one day with a simple realization.
I'm Jewish. But I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. I don't want to insult the Olive Garden, a lovely restaurant, but it's not very Italian, and I'm not very Jewish. But I had a child, and I wanted to know what to teach him. And I thought, millions of smart people found meaning in religion, and what am I missing? So I decided, all right, I am going to try to dive in headfirst and actually live the Bible.
Okay, quick detour here to explain that AJ, as a writer, has basically made a career out of decisions like that, diving into topics he knows almost nothing about. In fact, he's practically a living definition of the word amateur.
I looked it up, and it comes from amator, from Latin for love. So if I love a topic, as a writer, what I like to do is just dive into any topic and live it.
AJ writes about his amateur experiences in books or for Esquire magazine, where he's also an editor. And some of the things he's tried? Outsourcing his life.
So I hired a team of people in Bangalore, India, to do everything for me.
And what'd they do?
Oh, they answered my phone. They responded to emails for me. They argued with my wife.
Wait, what? How?
Oh, it was wonderful. My wife would bring up a topic, and I would say, hold that thought. I would tell them, and they would come up with a response and email it to her.
In another experiment, AJ decided to live according to a set of rules George Washington wrote as a young man, 110 rules of life.
Be respectful to your elders. Don't gloat when you are victorious. Some were less expected. The number two rule in George Washington's list is do not adjust your private parts in public.
Huh, that's the number two rule.
Well, that's what I'm fine with that rule. It's a good rule.
And more recently, AJ tried to become the healthiest person alive. He even went on a fad diet. It's called calorie restriction. And he had dinner with its founder.
The appetizer was a walnut, and the main course was a blueberry. That... And I will say, we all got our own walnut and blueberry. It's not like we had to share.
Basically, for AJ... living life as a professional amateur.
I love that, yeah.
Was a good way to get paid for collecting funny stories.
It's a little bit oxymoronic, but I am a professional amateur.
Until the experiment we talked about earlier. Because it wasn't just funny. It was actually life-changing.
I decided to write down every rule, every piece of advice, every nugget of wisdom that I could find in the Bible without picking and choosing. So I wanted to follow the famous ones, like love your neighbor and Ten Commandments. But I also wanted to follow the hundreds of rules that are not so famous.
AJ picks up the story from the TED stage.
The Bible says you cannot wear clothes made of mixed fibers. So I thought, sounds strange, but I'll try it. You only know if you try it. So I got rid of all my poly cotton t-shirts. The Bible says that if two men are in a fight, and the wife of one of those men grabs the testicles of the other man, then her hand shall be cut off. So I wanted to follow that rule. That one I followed by default, by not getting in a fight with a man whose wife was standing nearby, looking like she had a strong grip. So I will say it was an amazing year because it really was life-changing and incredibly challenging. And there were two types of laws that were particularly challenging. The first was avoiding the little sins that we all commit every day. You know, I could spend a year not killing, but spending a year not gossiping, not coveting, not lying. You know, I live in New York, and I work as a journalist. So this was 75, 80% of my day I had to do it. But it was really interesting because I was able to make some progress because I couldn't believe how much my behavior changed my thoughts. This was one of the huge lessons of the year, is that I almost pretended to be a better person, and I became a little bit of a better person. So I had always thought, you know, you change your mind and you change your behavior, but it's often the other way around. You change your behavior and you change your mind.
Wow, this really changed you. I mean, like following these rules.
Absolutely. That was one of the big lessons, how much the outer affects the inner, how much behavior affects your thoughts. There's a great phrase, it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting.
Like fake it till you make it.
Total fake it till you make it. This idea of trying things out, testing them out, and that's how you become an expert, is you actually live it.
That's the idea we'll explore on the show today, Amateur Hour. Ideas about what it takes to survive, even thrive, in situations where you have no idea what you're doing. And so for an entire year, living in New York City with his wife and his kids, A.J. Jacobs really did live by the rules of the Bible. Now, some of them were pretty easy to follow, like the rule that a man should not shave the corners of his beard.
I didn't know where the corners were, so I just let the whole thing grow. And by the end, I spent a lot of time at airport security. for real.
The Bible also says you should only wear white clothing, so AJ did.
But I have to say, there was something very cleansing and purifying about wearing all white. Yeah. And it goes back to that idea that the outer affects the inner. And by the end, I was really getting into it, and I would put on a robe.
But other rules? Not so easy to follow.
Perhaps the clearest example of this is stoning adulterers. It's a big part of the Bible, so I figured I had to address it. So I was able to stone one adulterer. It happened, I was in the park, and I was dressed in my biblical clothing, so sandals and sort of a white robe. And this man came up to me, and he said, "Why are you dressed like that?" And I explained my project, and he said, "Well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me?" And I said, "Well, that would be great." I took out a handful of stones from my pocket that I've been carrying around for weeks, hoping for just this interaction. And, you know, they were pebbles. But he grabbed them out of my hand. He was actually an elderly man, mid-70s, just so you know. But he's still an adulterer and still quite angry. He grabbed them out of my hand and threw them at my face. And I felt that I could, eye for an eye, I could retaliate and throw one back at him. So that was my experience stoning. And it did allow me to talk about, in a more serious way, these big issues, like how can the Bible be so barbaric in some places and yet so incredibly wise in others? How should we view the Bible? Should we view it, you know, as original intent, like a sort of a Scalia version of the Bible?
Okay, so a lot of this, was kind of silly, but it wasn't like a stunt, right? Like, I mean, you really did want to learn something from the Bible.
I did. I really earnestly wanted to see what about religion could make my life better. And one thing that really struck me was this idea of gratitude, because the Bible says that you should give thanks for everything in your life. And I took that literally. So I would press the elevator button, and I would be thankful the elevator came. I'd get in the elevator. I'd be thankful it didn't plummet to the basement and break my collarbone. And it was a strange way to live, but it was also quite beautiful because you realize there are hundreds of things that go right every day that we totally take for granted, and we focus on the three or four that go wrong.
Yeah.
And I've tried to keep this perspective, and it's made my life better. Another lesson is that thou shalt have reverence. This one was unexpected because I started the year as an agnostic, and by the end of the year, I became what a friend of mine calls a reverent agnostic, which I love. The basic idea is whether or not there's a God, there's something important and beautiful about the idea of sacredness, and that our rituals can be sacred, the Sabbath can be sacred. This was one of the great things about my year, was doing the Sabbath, because I am a workaholic, so having this one day where you cannot work, that changed my life. Also, thou shalt not disregard the irrational, because, you know, I grew up with the scientific worldview, and I was doing all these rituals, these biblical rituals, you know, separating my wool and linen, And I would ask these religious people, you know, why? Why would the Bible possibly tell us to do this? Why would God care? And they said, you know, we don't know, but it's just rituals that give us meaning. And I would say, you know, but that's crazy. And they would say, well, what about you? You blow out candles on top of a birthday cake. If a guy from Mars came down and saw, here's one guy blowing fire on top of a cake versus another guy not wearing clothes of mixed fabrics, would the Martian say, oh, well, that guy, he makes sense, but that guy's crazy? No, I think that rituals are, by nature, irrational. So the key is to choose the right rituals, the ones that are not harmful. But rituals by themselves are not to be dismissed.
Did this change your, I mean, did you come out of it thinking, okay, I am not an Olive Garden Jew anymore. I'm like more like a Cantor's Deli Jew.
A little bit. I did join a synagogue at the end of the year because I like the community. I like giving my kids a little sense of tradition and that they can reject or accept. You know, I'm okay if they grow up and decide to reject it, or I just want to give them a little base. And I also want to give them a little knowledge so that they can make jokes about it. You know, I think there's something very important about making fun of your heritage.
Of course, that heritage would have probably remained unknown to AJ and to his kids had he not admitted just how little he knew about it in the first place. That is, had he not been honest with himself and everyone else about just how much of an amateur he was.
Right. I am a big believer in that. Going in knowing that you know very little and knowing that life is full of unknowns and grays among the blacks and whites. And if you can do that and go in with an open mind and learn, I think that you can make your life a lot better by being an amateur.
AJ Jacobs, editor-at-large for Esquire magazine. His book on all this is called The Year of Living Biblically, and he's written many others as well. Check out all of his TED Talks at TED.com. Our show today, Amateur Hour, more in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and our show today, Amateur Hour. Ideas about jumping into the unknown and just kind of figuring it out.
My name is Taylor Wilson. I am 21 years old, and I'm an applied nuclear physicist.
Okay, that's weird.
Sure, but, you know, I've been doing it half my life now, so it doesn't seem that weird to me.
50% of your life since you were...
10 years old, yeah.
Wow, you've been a nuclear physicist since you were 10?
Well, that's when the spark hit me, so I've been working on it since.
Okay, just a quick pause here to explain that Taylor never got a college degree. He's never published a peer-reviewed journal article. He is completely self-taught. And at least when he first got into this stuff, a complete amateur.
You know, I realized that, you know, there was this field where people were basically manipulating atoms, you know, smashing them apart, combining them, using them for all these different things. And I thought, well, that sounds like fun. And then I realized I could do it. And that was the best part of all. You know, it's something I could kind of play around with in my garage.
To be precise, in his parents' garage.
Somewhere along that road, I decided I wanted to build a nuclear reactor, and so, you know, I was the youngest person to produce nuclear fusion when I turned 14, and then...
In case you just missed that, Taylor, at age 14, became the youngest person in history to produce nuclear fusion.
Fusion is the process that goes on inside the sun, inside all the stars in the universe around us. And it's basically taking very light fundamental atoms, things like hydrogen, helium, and fusing them together into bigger elements.
And Taylor achieved this by building his own nuclear reactor, which he described on the TED stage.
And I assembled this in my garage, and it now lives in the physics department of the University of Nevada, Reno. And it slams together deuterium, which is just hydrogen with an extra neutron in it. So this is similar to the reaction, the proton chain that's going on inside the sun. And I'm slamming it together so hard that hydrogen fuses together.
And the mass difference in those reactions is the energy produced.
At this point, you might be asking, how'd he do that in his parents' garage? And the answer, as you might have guessed, began by searching the internet.
You know, I was an email away from basically any physicist, professor throughout the world, you know, that I, if I had a question, I could shoot off an email to one of those contacts.
In the meantime, Taylor started gathering anything radioactive he could get his hands on.
All kinds of things. You know, your smoke detector has americium in it, an artificial element that doesn't occur naturally on Earth, and it uses the radiation to detect smoke.
He picked up some old radium alarm clocks because who knew? They have small amounts of radioactive material on the dial faces, which is what makes them glow. And he even found what he needed in dishes.
Fiestaware plates, the old orange-red Fiestaware plates that have uranium on them.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You know, the collection slowly got more and more advanced as I got things like, you know, nuclear fuel pellets. And some point I started doing was I'd go out in the desert and I would dig up a bunch of uranium ore and bring it in the garage and process yellowcake out of it.
I thought you could only get that from Saddam Hussein.
I mean, not really, but, you know. But, you know, at some point, I wasn't satisfied with that. I wasn't satisfied with, you know, collecting and building up things that were already radioactive or you know, naturally going through these nuclear reactions. You know, I wanted to make my own nuclear reactions. And to do that, I realized the easiest way to do it would be to produce nuclear fusion, build a nuclear fusion reactor.
Slowly, Taylor started to get some vacuum chambers, pumps, parts he'd pick up from Home Depot.
From industry, from government labs, all these different places. I remember one Christmas, I got the fuel for the reactor under the Christmas tree, which was the deuterium, the heavy hydrogen fuel.
Wow, that was under the Christmas tree?
Yeah, I asked for that for Christmas one year.
Like wrapped with a ribbon?
Yeah.
Here you go, some nuclear fuel.
There you go.
So by around early 2009, Taylor finally finished building his reactor. And don't picture like Three Mile Island. It actually looks like a Xerox machine from the 70s with a bunch of wires and pumps and tubes coming out of it.
What's called an inertial electrostatic confinement device, which basically means I was just using electricity, electrostatic potential, to confine ions. And you take in a little bit of a fusion fuel and you ionize it, you strip off the electrons. And
okay, so fusion is basically what happens when a hydrogen bomb explodes. The scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project were the first ones to achieve it back in 1951. But since then, what no one has figured out is how to turn nuclear fusion into power, like electricity.
The holy grail for power production is fusion, because fusion does not produce long-lived radioactive waste. And the fuel is just abundant. Now, I think it's possible, and I think it'll be very economically competitive once we do it. It's just all the challenges to get there. And it may be something where we need a moonshot, or we may get the lucky donkey who's doing it in his small startup. We have to see what'll work, but I'm convinced we'll get there.
So a world powered by nuclear fusion, for the moment, too challenging. So Taylor's decided to focus on something far easier, far simpler. And that would be nuclear fission. And just in case you overslept the day it was explained in high school, here is a quick primer.
Let's talk a little bit about how nuclear fission works. In a nuclear power plant, you have a big pot of water that's under high pressure, and you have some fuel rods. And a fission reaction heats up water, the water turns to steam, steam turns a turbine, and you produce electricity from it. This is the same way we've been producing electricity, the steam turbine idea, for 100 years. And nuclear was a really big advancement in a way to heat the water, but you still boil water, and that turns to steam and turns a turbine. And I thought, you know, is this the best way to do it? Is fission kind of played out, or is there something left to innovate here? And I realized that I had hit upon something that I think has this huge potential to change the world. This is what it is. This is a small modular reactor. So it's not as big as the reactor you see in the diagram here. This is between 50 and 100 megawatts, but that's a ton of power. That's
what Taylor's explaining here is that fission is basically what happens in a nuclear power plant. And about 20% of electricity in the US is generated by nuclear power. But those power plants are inefficient, and they create a whole bunch of nuclear waste. So Taylor's working on a new kind of fission reactor, It's small, it's twice as efficient, it could power up to 100,000 homes, all without the pollution of fossil fuels.
That in the, say, 20 years it's going to take us to get fusion and make fusion a reality, this could be the source of energy that provides carbon-free electricity.
Do you think that in some ways, like, not exactly knowing what you were doing when you started the process, like, definitely at first, I would imagine, do you think that in some ways that was, like, gave you an advantage, that you were almost so naive that you were like, yeah, I could build a nuclear reactor?
I think that, you know, people who have, you know, spent their professional careers in a field sometimes get bent to those preconceptions or the way things are done. And I think that young people don't necessarily develop those preconceptions. And so they just go out and do. And, you know, I didn't really know that, you know, this wasn't the way things were done, or I wasn't convinced this is the way they should be done. And I think that's my personality. I try to fight against every obstacle that comes into my way. And I've never let someone telling me no stop me, so to speak.
I wonder if like now with all you know, if there are things that you don't try anymore because, or you like limit yourself because you're just not an amateur anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll certainly say that I look back and sometimes I'm awestruck at how little I knew, or, you know, things like that. But with that said, you know, one thing that, you know, I hope I never lose is that lack of preconceptions, right? I think that one, you know, that's the nice thing about physics. Physics tells you what you can and can't do. And, you know, if you know the physics, anything else is possible, whether it's, you know, fiscal concerns, engineering, materials, all these things are within the realm of possibility if you know what physics tells you you can and can't do. And that's how I try to live my life and hopefully will continue to do so.
Taylor Wilson, nuclear physicist. You can see both of his talks at TED.com. So on the show today, we're asking what it means to be an amateur when you're so unprepared. You have no idea what you're getting yourself into.
I'm just thinking that's so funny because I feel that way about every single thing I've done.
This is the actor and writer Julia Sweeney. And the moment she felt like a complete novice, a complete amateur, like many people do, is when she became a parent. Parenting is like the prototypical amateur thing that nobody knows how to do it, right?
No, I think some people do know how to do it.
Really?
Yeah. I wasn't one of those people.
What did you think parenting was going to be like?
I thought I'd have this baby and she was going to look so cute and wear everything I bought for her and just when I wanted her to. And I wasn't even married. So I thought, oh, I'll continue to date and I'm going to take all these jobs. And I thought everything would be the same. And I thought of it like a puppy. Like, you can hire a dog walker. I mean, God.
Julia adopted her daughter Mulan from China when Mulan was about 18 months old. And when she brought her home, that's when reality set in.
There's an image in my mind at 3 in the morning, and I had a parenting book open to like a teething section. And she was screaming, crying, standing right next to my ear. And then I was crying, and my tears were falling onto the teething page. And it was like, this is a terrible thing that's happened to me. And her.
But even a tear-stained parenting book is better than no parenting book at all. And the story you're about to hear is about that. It's about a day when Julia realized she had no book, no plan. She was a total amateur.
Yes. It was a day that my daughter asked me a question and I was not prepared to give the answer. But it turned into a good story.
And just a quick heads up for parents out there, if you're listening with smaller kids, this is a story they might not be ready to hear yet. Here's Julia on the TED stage.
I have a daughter, Mulan, and when she was 8 last year, she was doing a report for school, or she had some homework about frogs, and we were at this restaurant, and she said, so basically, frogs lay eggs, and the eggs turn into tadpoles, and tadpoles turn into frogs. And I said, yeah, you know, I'm not really up on my frog reproduction that much. It's the females, I think, that lay the eggs and then the males fertilize them. And then they become tadpoles and frogs. And she says, what? Only the females have eggs? And I said, yeah. And she goes, and what's this fertilizing? So I kind of said, oh, it's this extra ingredient, you know, that you need to create a new frog from the mom and dad frog. And she said, oh, so is that true for humans too? And I thought, okay, here we go. I didn't know it would happen so quick at 8. I was trying to remember all the guidebooks, and all I could remember was, only answer the question they're asking. Don't give any more information. So I said, yes. And she said, and where do women lay their eggs? And I said, well, funny you should ask. We have evolved to have our own pond. We have our very own pond inside our bodies. And we lay our eggs there. We don't have to worry about other eggs or anything like that. It's our own pond. And that's how it happens. And she goes, and how do they get fertilized? And I said, well, men in their through their penis, they fertilize the eggs by the sperm coming out, and you go through the woman's vagina. And her jaw just drops, and she goes, Mom, like where you go to the bathroom? And I said, I know. That's how we evolved. It does seem odd. It is a little bit like having a waste treatment plant right next to an amusement park. Bad zoning. She goes, but Mom, but men and women can't ever see each other naked, Mom, so how could that ever happen? And then I go, well, and then I'm like, put my Margaret Mead hat on. Human males and females develop a special bond. And when they're much older, much, much older than you, and they have a very special feeling, then they can be naked together. And she said, Mom, have you done this before? And I said, yes. And she said, but Mom, you can't have kids, because she knows I adopted her and that I can't have kids. And I said, yes. And she said, well, you don't have to do that again. And I said, and then she said, but how does it happen when a man and a woman are together? Like, how do they know that's the time? Mom, does the man just say, is now the time to take off my pants? And I said, yes. That is exactly right. Exactly how it happens. So then we're driving home, and she's looking out the window, and she goes, Mom, what if just two people saw each other on the street, like a man and woman, they just started doing it? Would that ever happen? And I said, oh, no, humans are so private. Oh. And then she goes, what if there was like a party and there was just like a whole bunch of girls and a whole bunch of boys and there's a bunch of men and women and they just started doing it, Mom? Would that ever happen? And I said, oh, no, no. It's not how we do it. Then we got home and we see the cat and she goes, Mom, how do cats do it? And I go, oh, it's the same. It's basically the same. And then she got all caught up in the legs. But how would their legs go, Mom? I don't understand the legs. And I was like, she goes, Mom, everyone can't do the splits. And I go, I know, but the legs, and I'm like, the legs get worked out. And she goes, but I just can't understand it. So I go, you know, why don't we go on the internet and maybe we can see, like on Wikipedia. So we go online and we put in cats mating, and unfortunately on YouTube there's many cats mating videos. And we watch them, and I'm so thankful, because she's just like, wow, this is so amazing. She goes, what about dogs? So we put in dogs mating, and you know, we're watching it, and she's totally absorbed. And then she goes, Mom, do you think they would have on the internet any humans mating? And then I realized that I have taken my little 8-year-old's hand and taken her right into internet porn. And I looked into this trusting, loving face and I said, oh no. That would never happen. Thank you.
I think you did a pretty good job. I like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you, you know, you did everything you possibly could do.
Okay, good. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. I would grade you, and I would give you a grade A.
Oh, good. Yeah. Yay.
Yeah, and it's this is a tricky one to navigate.
Well, you know what it was, and I think I now that I've talked to other parents, I think many people make this mistake, but because I feel like I have a healthy attitude about sex, I'm not squeamish about it, it isn't embarrassing to me. I thought just because I had that attitude, it would make that conversation like any conversation like how to make an apple pie. Like it would just be nothing. And yet, it wasn't.
So do you think that actually doing something in a way where you don't have any experience at it and you're just sort of thrown into it, in some ways, like, is kind of an advantage?
Oh, yeah. I think if I really understood what parenting was going to take, I would not have done it. And I'm really glad I did it. It changed me completely. It changed my attitude about the world. It made me see everything in the world totally differently. And I needed to be a parent to really get it. But if I knew how much, what the price really was, which is basically 100% of your mind and 100% of your heart and soul, I don't think I would have done it. So thank you, universe, that I just had no idea.
Julia Sweeney's a writer, actor, and incredible TED speaker. You can see all of her talks at TED.com. Our show today, Amateur Hour. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. On the show today, ideas about amateurs and how they manage to succeed. Now, think of something you've never tried, but, you know, you've always wanted to, like maybe learning how to play an instrument or trying to write a novel or starting a business. Whatever it is, you are probably a complete amateur at this thing, right? Okay, if you want to actually accomplish it, here's a short talk from entrepreneur Derek Sivers with a secret for how to pull it off.
Imagine deciding right now that you're going to do it, okay? Imagine telling someone that you meet today what you're going to do. Your biggest personal goal, okay? For real, imagine their congratulations and their high image of you. Doesn't it feel good to say it out loud? Don't you feel one step closer already, like it's already becoming part of your identity? Well, bad news, you should have kept your mouth shut, because that good feeling now will make you less likely to do it. Repeated psychology tests have proven that telling someone your goal makes it less likely to happen. Anytime you have a goal, there are some steps that need to be done, some work that needs to be done in order to achieve it. Ideally, you would not be satisfied until you'd actually done the work. But when you tell someone your goal and they acknowledge it, psychologists have found that it's called a social reality. The mind is kind of tricked into feeling that it's already done. So this goes against the conventional wisdom that we should tell our friends our goals, right? So they hold us to it, yeah. So let's look at the proof. 1926, Kurt Lewin, founder of social psychology, called this substitution. 1933, Vera Mahler found when it was acknowledged by others, it felt real in the mind. 1982, Peter Goblitzer wrote a whole book about this, and in 2009, he did some new tests that were published. It goes like this. 163 people across four separate tests. Everyone wrote down their personal goal. Then half of them announced their commitment to this goal to the room, and half didn't. And then everyone was given 45 minutes of work that would directly lead them towards their goal, but they were told that they could stop at any time. Now, those who kept their mouth shut worked the entire 45 minutes on average, and when asked afterwards, said that they felt that they had a long way to go still to achieve their goal. But those who had announced it quit after only 33 minutes on average, and when asked afterwards, said that they felt much closer to achieving their goal. So, if this is true, what can we do? Well, you could resist the temptation to announce your goal. You can delay the gratification that the social acknowledgement brings, and you can understand that your mind mistakes the talking for the doing. But if you do need to talk about something, you could state it in a way that gives you no satisfaction. Such as, I really want to run this marathon, so I need to train 5 times a week and kick my ass if I don't, okay? So audience, next time you're tempted to tell someone your goal, what will you say? Exactly, well done.
Entrepreneur Derek Sivers. You can see more of his talks at TED.com. On the show today, Amateur Hour, stories and ideas from people who are put into situations where they have no idea what they're doing. I'm assuming you had never run an international movement in your life.
No.
This is Nancy Frates, and the story of how she came to be the voice and the face of a worldwide movement starts with her son, Pete, who was a star athlete for as long as Nancy can remember.
Oh, very early. Very early. I was told in fourth grade when he was 10 years old, his gym teacher came up to me and said she had been watching him since he was in first grade. And she said, he's a Division I athlete.
As Pete got older, autumn meant he was playing football. Winter, it was hockey. And in the summer, baseball.
I was the team captain, mother who would run, you know, all the team events.
Pete did, in fact, play Division I. It was baseball at Boston College. He was a star on the team, but not quite good enough to make the major league. So eventually, he gave up that dream. And he settled on a corporate job in Boston.
But Pete was still playing baseball. He was playing in an intercity league in Boston, which is pretty high-level league, and we were still going to baseball games.
And what happened next? Nancy tells the story from the TED stage.
So it takes me back to the summer of 2011. We're at the playoff game, Pete's at the plate, and a fastball's coming in, and it hits him on the wrist. His wrist went completely limp like this. So for the next 6 months, Pete went back to his home in Southie and was going to doctors to see what was wrong for this wrist that never came back. 6 months later in March, he called my husband and I and he said, oh, Mom and Dad, we have a doctor that found a diagnosis for that wrist. You want to come to the doctor's appointment with me? I said, sure, we'll come in. That morning, Pete, John, and I all got up, got dressed, got in our cars, walked into the neurologist's office, sat down, four doctors walk in, and the head neurologist sits down. And he says, well, Pete, we've looking at all the tests, and I have to tell you, it's not a sprained wrist. It's not a broken wrist. It's not nerve damage in the wrist. It's not an infection. It's not Lyme disease. And there was this deliberate elimination going up. And I was thinking to myself, where is he going with this? Then he put his hands on his knees, and he looked right at my 27-year-old kid and said, I don't know how to tell a 27-year-old this. Pete, you have ALS. ALS? I had had a friend whose 80-year-old father had ALS. I looked at my husband, he looked at me, and then we looked at the doctor, and he said, ALS? Okay, what treatment? Let's go. What do we do? Let's go. And he looked at us and said, Mr. and Mrs. Frades, I'm sorry to tell you this, but there's no treatment and there's no cure. We didn't even understand that it had been 75 years since Lou Gehrig and nothing had been done in the progress against ALS. So we all went home and Jen and Dan flew home from Wall Street. Andrew came home from Charlestown and Pete went to BC to pick up his then-girlfriend, Julie, and brought her home. And 6 hours later, after diagnosis, we're sitting around having a family dinner. And we're having small chat. I don't even remember cooking dinner that night. But then our leader, Pete, set the vision and talked to us just like we were his new team. He said, there will be no wallowing, people. He goes, we're not looking back, we're looking forward. What an amazing opportunity we have to change the world. I'm going to change the face of this unacceptable situation of ALS. We're going to move the needle, and I'm going to get it in front of philanthropists like Bill Gates. And that was it. We were given our directive.
Within days, Pete's family and friends created a website and a Facebook group. They called it Team Freight Train. And Pete started documenting these moments in his life, like when he proposed to his girlfriend Julie, or when they got married, and when they were expecting a baby girl. And his family used the page to raise awareness of ALS and also to collect donations for his care.
Uncle Dave, he was the webmaster. Uncle Artie, he was the accountant. Auntie Dana, she was the graphic artist. And my youngest son, Andrew, quit his job, left his apartment in Charlestown, and says, I'm going to take care of Pete and be his caregiver.
All the while this was happening, Pete was getting worse. In most cases, ALS progresses like this. First, you need help walking, then a wheelchair. Eventually, after a year or so, you're unable to move or speak at all.
Today, Pete's completely paralyzed. He can't hold his head up any longer. He's confined to a motorized wheelchair. He can no longer swallow or eat. He has a feeding tube. He can't speak. He talks with eye gazer technology and a speech generating device, and we're watching his lungs because his diaphragm eventually is going to give out. And then the decision will be made to put him on a ventilator or not.
So even though Pete was in the middle of this decline, Team Freight Train was building momentum. Pete had more than 4,000 followers on Facebook. Nancy was going to public events trying to promote awareness of the disease. And she was already starting to make that transition from amateur to professional organizer. And then, in the summer of 2014, that big opportunity Pete talked about when he was first diagnosed, the thing that would move the needle, it happened.
You know, everybody wants to know who put the first bucket over their head. Look, I can't even tell you that. It actually had been around the internet for months.
Nancy is talking about the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. You probably saw it, maybe you did it. And this is where it started. And it wasn't even for ALS initially, right?
No, it was for many, many other diseases, nonprofits. And the real story is there was a golfer in Florida.
Ice Bucket Challenge.
It came across his feed. His cousin's husband has ALS.
You're going to donate $100 to the ALS Foundation.
He sent it up to her in Westchester County, New York.
And this is to generate awareness about ALS.
She did it for ALS, Jeanette Sinertia. They were cross-referenced in a mutual feed with Pat Quinn. Now, Pat Quinn was being mentored by Pete Frates. So Pat Quinn called Pete Frates and said, I think we're going to take this. And they grabbed it and made it their own. They became purposeful and they became strategic. And they said, we're going to do this for ALS.
This is Ryan Cazalet accepting the Ice Bucket Challenge in support of Team Freight Train.
And to honor Pete Frates.
Pete Frates.
By about day four, Uncle Dave, the webmaster, yeah, he isn't on Facebook, and I get a text from him, and it says, Nancy, what the hell is going on? Uncle Dave gets a hit every time Pete's website is gone onto, and his phone was blowing up. So we all sat down and we realized money is coming in. How amazing. So we knew awareness would lead to funding. We just didn't know it would only take a couple of days. So we got together, put our best 501c3s on Pete's website, and off we went.
And that was it. It just kind of snowballed from there. Athletes started picking it up, like Derek Jeter and LeBron James. Actors.
Hi, I'm Jack Black.
Emma Stone did it.
And I hereby nominate Bill Murray.
Robert Downey Jr. Justin Timberlake.
JT here.
And Taylor Swift.
Oh, dear God, we're going to do this.
3, 2, 1!
George W. Bush did it.
Now it's my privilege to challenge my friend Bill Clinton.
And Bill Gates.
I'm going to challenge 3 more people. Elon Musk, Ryan Seacrest.
The one person Pete Frates wanted to reach. And within weeks, the Ice Bucket Challenge became one of the biggest and fastest fundraising campaigns in history. It would eventually raise $250 million for ALS charities, and Pete Frates and his mom Nancy, they would become the faces of that movement. At what point did you say, this is unbelievable? Like, do you remember that just thinking to yourself, this is crazy?
Yeah, we didn't, to be perfectly honest with you, we didn't have a whole lot of time to do that. This thing happened so fast. And what was going on in my house, of course, is we were trying to keep the motor going with the engagement.
You knew nothing about this.
Nothing.
Nothing. You had no medical background. You had no fundraising background.
Mm-mm.
Nothing.
No, but I had a business background.
Yeah.
And that's the skill set that we brought to this. We knew we could brand. And we looked as the awareness piece as branding. And we just knew if we tell people the reality of this disease, they'll open their hearts and then they'll open their wallets. Was I a social media whiz? I wasn't even on Facebook. I had to, you know, I had to get on Facebook and learn how to do that. But Pete was the one. When this thing happened, he told us, okay, this is what I want you to do. And quickly we picked up on it because it was using marketing skills and merchandising skills and branding skills. Those were very known to us and very comfortable to us. So we just kind of converted it to this new cause that we had. But it was also driven by not a paycheck. It was driven by the love of a child.
Do you ever, like, step back and think, like, how crazy it is that you went from knowing almost nothing about this disease or about leading a movement or, you know, starting a charity to becoming kind of like the face, like the mom of ALS research?
Put a challenge in front of me. Let me educate myself. Let me see what I can lend to it that will help it be productive, proactive. That's how I've kind of lived my whole life. A story that I haven't told often is that I am myself am a cancer survivor. I had cancer at 17. So when you stare down your own mortality at that age, you don't take a whole lot for granted. I've pretty much lived my life like that. And so this was just another piece, but it was my child.
Do you think, Nancy, that anybody would have the capacity to do what you've done, to be positive and upbeat, to be so forceful? Or do you think that you have a particular drive?
I think I choose to do this every day. Look, could I roll up in bed and put the covers over my head and cry every day? Absolutely. But taking the easy way out has really never been an option for me. And so I make a choice every morning to live my day in positivity because that's the only way I can help others.
That's Nancy Frates. Team Freight Train is still fighting for Pete. He recently had to go on a ventilator. His spirits are pretty good, though. He's calling himself the Bionic Man. The second annual ALS Ice Bucket Challenge is happening now. If you want to find out more, you can go to PeteFrates.com. And you can also find Nancy's talk at TED.com.
I will build you a castle with a tower so high it reaches the moon. I'll gather melodies from birdies that fly and compose you a tune. Give your love and warm and mama's oven, and if that don't do, then I'll try something new.
Hey, thanks for listening to our show this week, Amateur Hour. If you want to let us know what you think about the show, go to ted.npr.org and click on Contact Us. You can follow us on Twitter at TED Radio Hour. Mine is Guy Raz. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour. With help from Daniel Shukin, our intern is Sharif Youssef. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.